The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. James Blend is producing, Dave King engineering, and in Seattle, Pedro Bartes producing and engineering. Looking forward to a conversation with Dexter Van Zyl later this hour. He's a managing editor of the Middle East Forum publication, Focus on Western Islamism. Prior to his current position, he worked at the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. He'll join us to offer his perspective on what's happening there and the escalation that we are witnessing from here. That's coming up later this hour. Well, the IDF on Tuesday said that a hospital blast that reportedly claimed the lives of hundreds of civilians earlier in the day was caused by a misfired rocket launched by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. It's a terrorist group operating within the Gaza Strip. On October 17th at around 1900, the PIJ fired a missile salvo toward Israel. The foreign ministry wrote in an official statement, one of the missiles misfired, landing on an Al-Ali hospital in Gaza, causing severe damage, killing hundreds of Palestinians and injuring more, end quote. Well, according to intelligence information from several sources we have, I'm again quoting, the PIJ organization is responsible for the failed rocket fire that hit the hospital, the IDF said. According to the Israeli military's analysis of operational systems, an enemy rocket barrage was carried out toward Israel, which passed in the vicinity of the hospital when it was hit, the statement added. Well, the Palestinian Ministry of Health, a government body under the control of Hamas, previously claimed that an Israeli airstrike was responsible for the hospital explosion. The ministry said that an estimated 500 civilians were killed in that blast. The body's original statement was cited by international media outlets, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Politico, Al Jazeera, and the Associated Press, which singled out Israeli culpability in the attack before it could be confirmed who was responsible. Progressive House members, including Rashida Tlaib, as well as Ilhan Omar, cited articles relying on the Palestinian Ministry of Health reports to denounce the White House for supporting Israel and ignoring calls for an immediate ceasefire. Israel just bombed the Baptist hospital, killing 500 Palestinians, they wrote. The Israelis say that they have drone footage proving what actually happened. It's yet to be released, but that is expected at some time in the near future. Again, things escalating and many rushing to offer details that are yet unconfirmed. We'll see what happens and we'll follow that story. Meanwhile, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, he's canceled his participation in a meeting that was scheduled for Wednesday with President Biden, who is now on his way to Israel. Other Middle East leaders, a senior Palestinian official said, were also to be participating. Palestinian President Abbas canceled his participation in that meeting with the president and other leaders because of the accusation that Israel had bombed the hospital. He was scheduled to join Jordan's King Abdullah II and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi on Wednesday's summit in Amman, Jordan, where they were to discuss the latest Israel-Hamas war with Biden. The senior officials said Abbas was withdrawing his presence to protest the alleged Israeli airstrike on the hospital in Gaza. The Hamas health officials say it killed 500 people on Tuesday. Again, Israel said it is investigating the source of the explosion. They say they have footage from drones that prove where that missile originated and what happened to it. Well, the president is scheduled to visit Israel Wednesday in a show of support for the Israeli force continuing its bombardment of Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip. His visit was also supposed to include Jordan, but I just learned moments ago that Jordan has canceled a meeting slated for Wednesday with President Biden and other regional leaders in protest over that airstrike. Well, earlier in the day, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas canceled his participation in the meeting. Jordan's King Abdullah II and Egypt's President set for Wednesday. Later, Jordan's foreign ministry said told the state-run television that his country had canceled the summit, saying that the war between Israel and Hamas was pushing the region to the brink. He said the meeting would be postponed, although the president is on his way there now. Hamas has blamed Israeli military for the airstrike. The Israeli Defense Forces, as I mentioned, investigating the incident, say otherwise and say they have proof to demonstrate its origination and its striking the hospital. The rocket was fired from Gaza. They say it was in close proximity to the hospital at the time it was hit. The IDF said the president will visit Israel on Wednesday, and this is the backdrop in which he arrives there to speak with Israeli leaders in a show of support. He was slated also to meet with these other leaders, and that meeting, it appears at this point, will not happen. Meanwhile, Israelis in Turkey have been warned to depart the country immediately after Israel's National Security Council raised the travel warning to the country to its highest level. The body also raised the travel alert for Morocco to level 2, meaning Israelis in that country should stay vigilant, according to the Jerusalem Post. The warnings come after 2 Israeli tourists were killed in Egypt last week when a policeman opened fire on them in Alexandria. Well, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken announced Monday evening that the president visiting Israel was going to be an important opportunity for him to speak to the leaders in the region. As we've just mentioned, we learned just moments ago that the Jordanian president would not be attending, nor will Mahmoud Abbas be attending either. Many are suggesting that this trip would be the riskiest of the president's, his tenure. Joe Biden is heading to the Middle East on the potentially riskiest trip of his presidency, aiming to thread the needle between supporting Israel against Hamas, averting catastrophe in Gaza, and preventing a regional war. Things seem to have fallen apart before he touches down in the country. The U.S. president flew into a war zone, or is flying into a war zone, for high-stakes talks with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in key ally Israel on Wednesday, then head to Jordan for that 4-day summit. Again, that's not going to happen. The 80-year-old Biden's diplomatic drive will be one of the biggest gambles of his long career in both political and security terms, and a test of U.S. influence in a tinderbox region. He's coming here at a critical moment for Israel, for the region, and for the world. That's what the U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said as he announced the president's visit during his own marathon diplomatic drive. The New York Times called it the trip fraught with risks. Well, Biden made a top secret trip to war-torn Ukraine last year to demonstrate U.S. support for the pro-Western country's battle against Russian invasion, this time not so covert. Despite frequent air raids warnings, U.S. officials say the security threat to Biden in Israel is lower, but the political stakes on the visit are arguably far higher. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgine Rice. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with Dexter Van Zyl. He's the managing editor of the Middle East Forum publication, Focus on Western Islamism. He'll join us to talk about developments in the Middle East. Well, Joe Biden's presidency is tracking Jimmy Carter's 4 years in the Oval Office so faithfully, it must give his campaign team hives. Well, so says Liz Peek, writing for Fox News. She points out that recent events in Israel create even more parallels. It was a Middle East crisis that brought down Jimmy Carter's presidency. The current conflict in the region could prove Biden's undoing as well. In 1979, for those of you who weren't around at the time, more than 50 U.S. citizens were taken hostage in Iran, and Carter failed to secure their release. Worse, a U.S. military mission sent to rescue the prisoners failed, infuriating Americans. Carter's foreign policy blunders sank his reelection bid, but they were far from his only problem. His administration was considered weak and inept, and the events of Tehran reinforced those perceptions. Well, like Biden, Carter was already in trouble when the hostage crisis occurred. The Georgia peanut farmer presided over sky-high inflation. So was Biden. Carter pushed enormous and controversial increases in government spending. Ditto, Biden. And like the current president, the former president started with high approval numbers that went pretty much straight downhill. Well, as he approached re-election in 1980, Carter faced a primary battle from fellow Democrat Senator Ted Kennedy. Nearing next year's presidential election, another Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., was until recently attempting to mount a primary challenge against Biden. The two are not quite equivalent politically, but you get the idea. History may not repeat it itself, but it sure does have something of a rhythm. Well, today, 30 Americans have been murdered by the Hamas, the terrorist organization. More than a dozen are being held captive. Voters will hold President Biden responsible for punishing the terrorists responsible for those deaths and for bringing both American hostages and those trapped by war home safely. So far, the White House is not impressed. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan boasted 8 days before Hamas invasion of Israel that the Middle East region is quieter today than it's been in two decades, displaying either incredible ignorance or unjustifiable smugness, although, in fairness, Israel didn't see it coming either. Elsewhere, it turns out that Robert Milley, the Biden administration's special envoy to Iran, who is known to have had close contacts with Hamas, was put on leave from the State Department post several months ago. Officially, he's been accused of mishandling classified documents, but there is speculation that he has long worked on behalf not of the U.S., but Iranian interests. Biden and his national security team have refused to accuse Iran of complicity in Hamas' attack on Israel, claiming repeatedly there's no evidence of Tehran's involvement, although they underwrite the cost of Hamas and Hezbollah. There is increasing proof that the planning of the attack went on for months, discussed by senior officials of both Hamas and Hezbollah, meeting with leaders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard in Beirut. Well, the president is understandably loath to implicate Iran in Hamas atrocities. Confronting Tehran could escalate the hostilities in the region, would also boost oil prices, which would inevitably hurt Biden's approval ratings. Also, the White House foolishly pursuing a nuclear pact has enriched and emboldened the mullahs, in part by loosening enforcement of sanctions. Voters will not look kindly on that decision if they recall what happened. Wisconsin Representative Scott Fitzgerald wrote recently in an op-ed, relaxing sanctions has allowed Iran to generate oil revenue exceeding $80 billion annually while strengthening its relationship with China. As a warning came up in April of 21, using China to dodge U.S. sanctions allows Iran to funnel money to its proxy forces in the Middle East, including the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps and Hamas, which is armed, funded, and led by the Iranian regime. At the same time, there's been a spike in the number of people on the terror watch list who've been apprehended at the uncontrolled southern border here in the U.S., through which millions of people have entered our country since Biden took office. It's been reported that four Iranians have been caught since October 1st, heightening concerns. Our State Department has been slow to help evacuate Americans from Israel, even as other countries have arranged to airlift their citizens to safety. In addition, recent news reports show U.S. citizens responding to our government's advisory and arriving at the Egyptian border only to find it blocked and being told to go home. The Biden White House claims to be surging additional military assistance to our ally, given that the president goofed some months ago by admitting that the conflict in Ukraine has drained our stocks of munitions. It's not clear how much we can provide. They do use different munitions. That might help. Hamas, on the other hand, appears to be well equipped, thanks at least in part to the mountains of weapons and ammunition abandoned by U.S. forces in their hasty exit from Afghanistan, which the president and his team continue to applaud as a success. Well, I could go on, but we'll talk with someone who has a better inside track. Dexter Von Zeil will be joining us in just a few moments. But we are in a very precarious position. And I'm referring to the world in general. Well, in other news, GOP senators could block Jack Lew from becoming Israel's next ambassador over controversial past with Iran. Well, some GOP senators are signaling that they oppose the president's nominated Jack Lew from the ambassadorship to Israel due to his record on Iran relationships during his time as Secretary of the Treasury. Lew will appear before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Wednesday for a nominating hearing. In 2018, a Senate report by the Investigative Subcommittee of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee found that Liu, during his tenure as Secretary of the Treasury under the Obama administration, granted a specific license that authorized a conversion of Iranian assets worth billions of U.S. dollars using the U.S. financial system. The report found that the administration tried to convert $5.7 billion from U.S. banks to Iranian assets. It noted that the Treasury Office of Foreign Assets Control encouraged two U.S. correspondent banks to convert their funds. Senator Tom Cotton, who sits on the Senate Armed Services Committee, said on Monday evening that he will vote to oppose Liu during a confirmation vote. Again, that's tomorrow. And that he will be leading an effort to persuade other GOP colleagues that this week to block that confirmation. I know my Democratic colleagues contend that we should confirm Jack Liu properly to show the support for Israel, but I would turn that around. We should defeat Jack Liu's nomination to show our nation has a new policy toward Iran. Jack Liu, Biden's nominee to be USAMB, the ambassador to Israel, was a key point man in negotiations and disinformation campaign for Obama's dangerously flawed deal with Iran. Senator Bill Hagerty posted on X, formerly Twitter, "The consequences are felt today as Iran, flush with cash due to Biden's push to revive the deal at any cost, has fueled carnage in Israel." Again, that vote is expected to take up to be taken up on Tuesday. Well, as much as Palestinian apologists bemoan Israel's supposed oppression of the Arab population living in the Gaza Strip, the truth is that nobody wants them. With Hamas terrorists running the show in Gaza, it's effectively a situation of the inmates running their own prison. Palestinians are suffering in Gaza primarily because of Hamas rather than, well, Israel. So with this latest war between Israel and Hamas, Palestinians will once again be the biggest losers. Israel is on the cusp of launching a massive ground assault through which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to eradicate Hamas once and for all. Yet the Islamic Middle Eastern nations that feign concern for the Palestinians are absolutely unwilling to accept them as refugees, even temporarily. Egypt could open its border with Gaza to let millions or so fleeing refugees flow into the country, but it won't. This works in Hamas' favor as its jihadists use civilians as human shields to protect themselves from Israel's military assault, banking on a high civilian casualty count to win sympathy from the rest of the world that has been duped into overlooking its anti-Semitic credo. At least one European official sees clearly through Hamas' gambit. That's German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock. Insightfully observed, Hamas brings nothing but suffering and death to the people in Israel and in Gaza. It is Hamas's perfidious strategy to use the civilian population as a human shield. Terrorism, cynical plan, must not be allowed to take hold. Civilians need safe places where they can find protection and have their essential needs met. But as noted above, Egypt won't provide that safe space. So is Egypt the bad guy here, or Jordan or Saudi Arabia? What these Middle Eastern nations know is that accepting a massive influx of refugees is no small matter, as it can create politically and economically destabilizing events. And there is no guarantee that Hamas terrorists won't slip in with the Palestinian refugees. It is something of a mess. We're going to talk about that mess with Dexter Van Zyl. He'll be joining me in just a few moments. So stay with us. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgine Rice. Some of the headlines I'm reading today: Mideast teeters on brink of wider war. Biden's trip riskiest of his presidency. High risk stakes visit. Abbas cancels planned meeting with president after hospital strike. IDF blames Islamic Jihad rocket launch for blast. Hundreds killed. Protesters attempt to storm Israeli embassy in Amman. Has Israel decided not to launch a ground invasion? IDF warned of booby traps, ambushes. With deadlocks, hipster beards, reservists called up. Iran vows preemptive action. Revolutionary Guard threatened shockwaves. USA mulls military response to Hezbollah. There's a lot going on, and here to help us make sense of it is Dexter Van Zyl. He's a managing editor of the Middle East Forum publication, Focus on Western Islamism. Prior to his current position, he worked at the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. His articles have appeared in the Jerusalem Post, the Boston Globe, Jewish Political Studies Review, the Allgemeiner, and the Jewish News Syndicate. He's authored numerous articles and academic studies and has been a contributor on Christian anti-Zionism. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me, Georgine. It's great to be here.
Well, before I begin with my questioning, let me just ask you to respond to the events that are taking place following the seventh invasion by Hamas into Israel. Your thoughts on what's happening there?
Well, I think the first thing is that the consequences are going to have to come down the pike for the people who helped to execute, plan, and facilitate this attack, which really has all the markings of a combination of essentially, I hate to say it, but it's like a pogrom. It was like a Kristallnacht crossed with 9/11. It's a terrible, terrible event that's going to go down in Israeli history as probably one of the worst moments of its collective life. It's just a terrible attack. And essentially, it's changed, I think, the discourse in Israel forever.
Yeah, yeah. Why do you think the Gaza ground invasion has been delayed since Friday? I know that some are speculating that the fact that President Biden is flying into Israel might be one explanation. Your thoughts on the delay? I think people anticipated this was going to happen sooner rather than later, and yet Israel has not crossed into Gaza.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, my instinct is that the idea to go into the Gaza Strip right now without a very serious plan of how to defeat Hamas is probably going to cost a lot of lives. And regardless of whatever happens or however well they plan it, the Israelis are going to lose a huge number or a significant number of troops. There's really no question around it. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why they want to figure out a way to essentially be able to defeat Hamas with as few casualties as possible. And I still think that they're going to be looking at a significant number of casualties.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
And that's,
I think,
if
that's what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's if you're just looking at Gaza. What about Hezbollah? There's the fact that it could broaden into another area in Israel, and that would certainly complicate their massing troops in one area as opposed to two and possibly more.
Right. One of the reports that I read said they called up about, over 100,000 troops and 300,000 troops showed up. Everybody wants to go into the Gaza Strip. Everybody is ready to go. And so the problem is that if they devote too many resources and they pull too many troops out of northern Israel, that might encourage Hezbollah to launch an attack from Lebanon in the north. And that would actually essentially create a two-front war. And also there's a possibility that Syria might get involved. There have been reports of Israeli attacks on air bases in Syria to prevent the arrival of weapons from Iran. And so what we're looking at, a multi-front war if things really go terrible for Israel, and it will be essentially a very difficult existential war for Israel. And it's had a number of them, and I don't have any doubt that it will pull through. But I think that there's an awful lot of discussion and planning about how best to defeat Hamas in the Gaza Strip without putting other parts of the country at risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as you know, President Biden is on his way right now to the nation of Israel. He had anticipated, of course, making an appearance in Israel to reinforce his support for the nation. I think there's some of us who are concerned about the message he might bring with him in terms of the United States support for the nation and whether or not we stand with him in trying to gut Hamas out of Gaza. But he was also planning to meet with President Abbas from the Palestinians, the Jordanian president, who has King Abdullah, who has now said that he will not be attending the meeting. And my understanding is it has been canceled. How significant is that? The president is making his, or they said it's postponed, is making his way there now, and there is not a meeting to be had with these leaders from the Arab nations.
Well, I think that probably what they're doing is that they're trying to figure out what happens next in the Gaza Strip. And I think that at this point, I sincerely hope that the Biden administration is not going to try and pressure Israel to engage in some sort of ceasefire with Hamas, because Israel has every right to prosecute operations against Hamas until it has concluded that the threat no longer exists. And essentially that, I think, is the real concern, is that maybe President Biden might try to put some pressure on Israel essentially like go soft on Hamas, or basically do some sort of arrangement where it doesn't invade and doesn't destroy the organization. And as I've been telling my friends and anybody that will listen, that Hamas has to be destroyed. It simply cannot be in a position to control the Gaza Strip after what it did on October 7th. It's done.
President Biden, as I mentioned, is heading to the Middle East, and many are suggesting that this could be the riskiest of the president's ventures. Your thoughts on the role he's likely to play, that he could play, or whether or not you expect he'll fall short in representing the interests of Israel and the United States?
Well, I think, this is the problem, is what does he hope to accomplish with this trip? It would be one thing if he visited Israel after the threat was defeated and after Hamas was essentially destroyed. And the problem is that, is he trying to promote peace, or is he trying to essentially, assist Israel or boost its morale prior to a conflict? I'm not really sure what he's trying to accomplish. And the thing is that if he's trying to somehow mollify Israel before it goes in to defeat Hamas, I think that's not really a very good strategy to pursue. And there's another issue, is that, frankly, I am concerned for the president's physical safety. Mm-hmm. Israel is a very dangerous place right now. And, so it's kind of like, why would you go there before essentially Hamas was defeated? Why would you do that? Why would you risk it? And do you honestly think that you're going to be able to broker some sort of peace deal before Hamas is destroyed? I don't get it.
Hmm. Dennis Prager published an article just recently, and he quotes the charter it's the Haggadah. In every generation, they arise to annihilate us. It's a statement that appears in the Haggadah. It's the book read from at the Passover Seder. It's the book is about 1,000 years old. The statement more than 2,000 years old. A generation or two ago, it was the Nazis who arose to annihilate the Jews. In this generation, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, and other Islamic movements have risen to annihilate the Jews. The word Nazi is overused, but in this case, is it a fair comparison to suggest that that is ultimately the goal here? It's not just Zionism, it's the annihilation of the Jews.
Yes, it is a fair characterization. One of the things that really, I have been thinking about in the past few months, I have basically been dealing with issues related to anti-Semitism since 2005. And I had been thinking that, the Holocaust really no longer really had the impact on people's conscience or imagination that it used to. My father, he served in World War II. He was an inveterate enemy of anti-Semitism. He hated it. He was a Protestant, and we were Christians, and we just hated it. And the problem was is that when the history of the Holocaust faded from memory, it was like, okay, we're going to have to figure out another way to tell people that anti-Semitism is bad. And then you wake up on Saturday, 10 days ago. And essentially you find out that there are people who are engaging in the same type of pogrom-esque tactics. These people behave like Einsatzgruppen during World War II. And it was unbelievable, the footage that we could see. It was unbelievable to see the young men and women running from a dance party in southern Israel from people who were essentially just gunning them down like it was, in the Baltics or in the Ukraine or Poland. It was a shock.
Yeah, it certainly was.
Yeah.
We're going to need to take a break, but we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. So if you can, please stay with us. Again, we're talking with Dexter Van Zyl. He's the managing editor of the Middle Eastern Forum publication, Focus on Western Islamism. And prior to that position, he worked at the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm continuing my conversation with Dexter Van Zyl. He's a managing editor of the Middle Eastern Forum publication, Focus on Western Islamism. Prior to his position, he worked with the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. His articles have appeared in the Jerusalem Post, Boston Globe, Jewish Political Studies Review, and many, many other publications. Just before the break, we were talking about how shocking it was to hear the stories of what was being done to civilians in Israel. It wasn't collateral damage. It didn't happen while they were fighting with members of the Israeli military. But I think what was even more shocking, and perhaps shouldn't have been, was the campus radicalism that was uncovered here in this country. It wasn't just a matter of saying we support the Palestinians, but they were calling for the annihilation of the Jews. It was as if we were back in Nazi Germany, and some of the things that were being said clearly wasn't just pro-Palestinian. It was hatred and anti-Semitism that I hadn't seen quite so brazen, at least in recent memory.
Right. One of the things that you'll see if you go on social media, you'll see images of young Muslim women essentially taking down posters of calling for Israeli children to be released by Hamas in the Gaza Strip to be returned to Israel. And what type of enmity does it require to essentially take down a poster put up by, possibly a relative of these children saying, please, give us our child back. And essentially they were brazen and they were caught right on video and they didn't care. They essentially, they just shrugged off any shock that people would direct their way. And the protests that we've seen are, essentially they make me very worried about the status of civil society in the West, because anti-Semitism is a barometer of problems in the larger culture. And I think this is really one of the problems that we have, is that essentially we're starting to see civil society break down. And one of the things that really bothers me is that the techniques that have been used to demonize Israel over the past 20 or 30 years have been increasingly directed at Western democracies as well. And essentially, and what they've done is that they basically prompted people to, officials to abandon the monopoly on force in the cities throughout the country. We see that. And ultimately, those tactics we saw, during the riots that took place after 2020, essentially the techniques used to delegitimize the United States and the rule of law in the U.S. were all essentially refined and practiced against Israel. And so these protests, when you see these protests in major cities throughout the United States, you see that there's a large cadre of people that not only hate Israel, but they really hate the United States as well. And that, I think, is a very troubling thing.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I suppose, though, when you hire unrepentant terrorists and Marxist revolutionaries as professors in colleges and universities, it shouldn't be altogether surprising.
Absolutely.
Yeah. My understanding is in June, the Middle East Forum released a policy paper challenging Israel's passive, as they called it, mow the lawn Gaza policy, instead presenting a path toward Israeli victory. The paper called on Israel to rid itself of Hamas's threat by disarming it, prohibiting its rearmament, demonstrating conclusively the cost of threatening Israel. The time to implement the policy is now. That was June of this year. There seems to be some consternation about what Israel ought to do. We heard from the president of Israel that we're going to eliminate the Hamas threat, which is a very difficult, if not a possible, thing to do. Your thoughts on the way forward for Israel as it attempts in its own national interest, and I would argue in the interest of the Palestinian people, who are largely victims of Hamas and its policies that sees them as human collateral. Your thoughts on Israel moving forward?
Well, I think, first of all, the prosecution of the war by Israel can and will follow and should follow the Geneva Conventions and the laws of warfare. That, I think, is very crucial. And I think that we can expect Israel to do that. And there are times when, you know, tragedies are going to happen in the conflict. And essentially, I think that the Israelis are going to hold themselves accountable. But the problem is that Hamas has already committed numerous war crimes and continues to do so by purposely using civilians to shield its terrorist army and infrastructure. It routinely hides its weapons and, you know, its headquarters or its meeting places in civilian buildings such as hospitals. And the problem is, because of that, any attempt to create a scoreboard of like, well, there's like maybe 1,400 Israeli dead versus 3,000 Palestinians who have died, that's illegitimate. The blame for every single death as a result of this conflict is on the hands of Hamas. And I think that's really, Hamas has to be defeated. And at the same time, Israel is not responsible for creating a follow-on government in the Gaza Strip once Hamas is destroyed. But it should it has every right to maintain military control of the area until it's satisfied that a new entity can function. And I'm not sure what that's going to look like. And I don't think that whoever replaces Gaza is going to be a Zionist organization. They're not going to be pro-Israel. They're not going to like Israel. They're not going to like Jews. But they're going to have to make it perfectly clear that they will never, ever attack Israel again. And that, and what happened on October 7th is going to be a blight on Palestinian history and on its, you know, its national identity for generations. And but that's, I think, the crucial thing is that whatever replaces Hamas has to know that they have to give up their plan to destroy Israel.
The Islamic Middle Eastern nations that feign concern for the Palestinians are unwilling to accept them as refugees. I'm thinking of Egypt and Jordan, Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure they're the bad guys. Hamas, they're the bad guys here. But your thoughts on the refugee issue and even for temporary shelter for Palestinians in the Gaza region, why don't these nations, why are they unwilling to shelter them even temporarily in these circumstances?
Oh, well, because one of the reasons why is because the Islamist movement historically hasn't been just anti-Western, and it hasn't just been anti-Israel and anti-Semitic, but it's also essentially worked to overthrow governments throughout the region. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that essentially, you know, the Palestinian Liberation Organization essentially tried to overthrow the government in Jordan. They got kicked out of there. They went to Lebanon. They basically, you know, helped initiate and worsen a civil war in that country. They murdered a lot of Christians in Lebanon. And then essentially the leadership was, you know, eventually allowed back into the Holy Land by the Oslo Accords. And they were Palestinians that did not want to see Arafat return in 94. But once he was returned and they put him in, you know, put him in control, essentially they created a terrible problem. The fact is that these other countries don't really want the Palestinians in their country, in part because I think they're afraid that they will destabilize their countries as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time, and there's so much more we could talk about maybe on another occasion. But I thank you so much for joining us today and helping us to perhaps understand a bit better what's happening there, to help us know how to pray for the key players and the people who are in the middle of it all. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Georgine.
Appreciate it. Again, my guest, Dexter Van Zyl. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. News up next.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the second hour of The Georgine Rice Show. James Blind and David King producing and engineering today's program. Pedro Bartez producing and engineering in Seattle. Well, declaring I do not need to hear any campaign rhetoric in my court, a federal judge, known for strict sentencing of the January 6th Capitol riot defendants on Monday, imposed a gag order on former President Donald Trump. U.S. District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan, who's overseeing the case in which the former president is charged with four felony counts of conspiracy, approved the gag order sought by special counsel Jack Smith. Judge Chutkan has yet to issue in writing the ruling, but during a more than two-hour court hearing from the bench, she said the court would restrict the 45th president and candidate for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination from denigrating Smith or the special counsel staff or court staff and from speaking about witnesses who may testify in the case. The judge did, however, deny the special counsel's broader request to prevent Trump from publicly criticizing the District of Columbia as a jury pool or to restrict him from criticizing the Biden administration or the Justice Department. Well, that marks the second gag order against the former president this month. A New York state judge imposed a limited gag order on Trump in the civil trial brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James to prevent the former president from talking about court staff. Seven Republicans voted for Majority Leader Steve Scalise, who was the previous speaker designate, before being forced to withdraw due to mounting opposition. Six GOP lawmakers voted for the ousted ex-speaker Kevin McCarthy, and three moderate New York Republicans voted for former GOP representative, Lee Zeldin. Well, additional votes were cast for House Rules Committee Chairman Tom Cole, Majority Whip Tom Emmer, Representative Mike Garcia, Representative Thomas Macy. But it may not be the end of Jordan's bid for the gavel. His allies have signaled that the GOP bomb thrower is willing to go through multiple rounds of votes to get a majority. And in fact, that may be happening right now. We don't know. He could become the speaker without a House majority with a risky gambit last used before the Civil War. In the chaotic fight to replace the recently ousted speaker, Kevin McCarthy, Jordan, he's been making calls to shore up support for his bid after House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, the initial nominee, bowed out due to a lack of support in the divided Republican caucus. However, Jordan doesn't necessarily need to get the required House majority to take the gavel. The House has elected a speaker a few times in history on a plurality rather than an outright majority. Well, the House is allowed to decide how the speaker election is held, according to the House practice, so changing the threshold as an option on the table. In fact, there have been two plurality elections to decide House Speaker in American history. In 1856, during the 34th Congress ahead of the Civil War, the House faced a fractured chamber after concessions and dividing lines over slavery had been burned into the sand. A fledgling Republican Party, a decimated Democrat Party, the nativist American Know Nothing Party, and a declining Whig Party could not decide on a top House lawmaker. Well, when the voting began, 21 members received votes backing them for Speaker on the first ballot, throwing the House into a deadlock that lasted for 2 months. Well, with the votes, American Party Representative Felix Zollicoffer of Tennessee introduced and passed a House resolution having the three top candidates for Speaker to publicly state their opinions of Congress' recent actions on the spread of slavery to the Western territories. Even after the questioning session, the House couldn't decide on a Speaker. Well, that deadlock was broken when the House voted to reduce the threshold to elect the Speaker from the traditional simple majority to a plurality election. After 133 votes, Speaker Nathaniel Banks of the Know-Nothings, shouldn't we have a Know-Nothing party now? That seems appropriate. Anyway, from the Know-Nothings was elected as Speaker of the 34th Congress with 103 votes backing him. Well, before then, during the 31st Congress in 1849, the House was without a Speaker for 19 days, with neither the Whigs or the Democrats holding a House majority and the Free Soil Party splitting the votes further. The first ballot was a split one that didn't yield a speaker, leading to several weeks of elections to determine the leader of the House. After 13 ballots, then Representative Andrew Johnson of Tennessee proposed a resolution to lower the speaker election threshold to a plurality, as well as an amendment to the ballot, the election. Well, the resolution and amendment passed, and Georgia Democrat Representative Howell Cobb was elected speaker via plurality after 63 votes. Three votes after the rules had been changed. Well, the House Judiciary Committee chairman has made headway, flipping key no votes to support him. But there's still a real chance that his bid to be the speaker will be dashed on the House floor. Scalise faced a problem that Jordan is working to solve, getting the numbers up in a slim majority to propel him behind the gavel. Well, historically, there is precedent for a plurality speaker election, but the move is risky if the math doesn't add up. Any miscalculation on votes in a plurality election would run the risk of the GOP inadvertently handing the speakership to the Democrats should the GOP members break from the party. However, should the GOP need a nuclear option to choose a new speaker, historical precedent provides one. We'll keep watching what happens next. In other unrelated news, just over 6 months after criminal charges were dropped against Alec Baldwin for the 2021 killing of Rust cinematographer Halyna Hutchins, new involuntary manslaughter claims could be put before the grand jury in a matter of weeks. After extensive investigation over the past several months, additional facts have come to light that we believe show Mr. Baldwin has criminal culpability in the death of the cinematographer and the shooting of Joel Souza. The special prosecutors, Carrie Morrissey and Jason Lewis, today said of the tragedy of the New Mexico set of the indie Western on October 21st, 2 years ago. We'll continue to follow that story. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgine. Well, there's growing skepticism over the president's claim that the $6 billion to Iran is now frozen. U.S. officials and the Qatari government have agreed to stop Iran from accessing the $6 billion account for humanitarian assistance in light of Hamas's attack on Israel. Deputy Treasury Secretary Wally Adiyamo told House Democrats on Thursday the deal, financed by Iranian oil sales, allowed Iranian entities, not the Iranian government, to access the funds, and only if they provided extensive documentation showing the money will be used for humanitarian purposes. So the U.S. officials would have to approve each transaction under the agreement. The money had been transferred to Qatar from banks in South Korea to facilitate the arrangement. Well, the Post report doesn't say that Qatar is refusing to disperse the funds to third parties at Iran's discretion, or that the transfer of the $6 billion is otherwise rescinded. Unless that happens, this announced agreement with Qatar would just be a faint hint. Well, the issue has never been Iran's direct access to the funds. It's whether Iran can benefit from them. Obviously, whether Iran possesses the funds or can decide to whom Qatar can disperse the funds, it would have the capacity to spend them on its governmental needs. Money being fungible, Iran could repurpose what it has already allocated to those governmental needs, i.e. use it to support terrorism operations by Hamas, Hezbollah, and other jihadist proxies. Although they have a lot of other oil money available as well. Well, Bill Ackman has doubled down on his push to have companies refuse employment opportunities to the Harvard students who signed a letter blaming Israel for Hamas violent attacks that killed more than 1,200 people, 1,300, I believe, is the current number, over the weekend. The hedge fund billionaire who founded Pershing Square Capital Management held his ground after a Harvard law student slammed him for harassment in response to a social media post on X in which he demanded a list of the signatories of that controversial letter. He offered some free advice, advice to students. If an organization of which you are a member puts out a public statement you disagree with, you have a few choices. You can stay silent and have the entire world conclude that you stand by that statement, convince the other members of the group to withdraw or otherwise modify the statement so that it can reflect the views of all its members, or you can resign in protest. Five organizations that we know of to date have withdrawn their signatures from that statement. President Biden is looking to create a welfare system for 5.7 million migrants in the country illegally. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement is overseeing 5.7 million migrants in the U.S. who could soon be provided free medical services, food, and even housing by the administration. The Post has learned, this is the New York Post, the record number of non-detained migrants being monitored by the federal agency, 2.4 million, more than before the president became president, was buried in paperwork detailing its release and reporting management program. The plan is for vendors to join ICE's monitoring of migrants through ankle monitors, phone apps, and in-person check-ins. However, the initiative also aims to provide a range of other perks to the non-citizens on the taxpayers' dime. The program would cost billions and effectively be a welfare program for non-detained migrants awaiting court dates, according to the former ICE director, Tom Homan. The consumer price index keeps rising. Prices that consumers pay for a wide variety of goods and services increased at a slightly faster than expected pace in September, keeping inflation in the spotlight for policymakers. The consumer price index, a closely followed inflation gauge, increased 0.4% on the month and 3.7% for the year, rather from a year ago. Star of David graffitied in Germany. It's being painted on the homes and stores of Jews in Berlin. It's been graffitied on the doors of homes there in a chilling echo of anti-Semitism persecution of Jewish people under the Nazis. Pictures circulating online show the symbol was drawn on several buildings, with four cases reported to German police in recent days. Jewish people living in the German capital have reported a rise in abuse following the Hamas bloody attack on Israel last week. The incidents amount to a crime under German law and seems to be an imitation of the persecution of Jews during the 1930s. During the Holocaust, Nazi brown shirts painted the Star of David in white on the doors of Jewish businesses to discourage non-Jewish Germans from going into them and doing business. Saudi Arabia indicated that it will shift its focus from talks with Israel to talks with Iran following the Hamas terrorist attack last week. But an expert says that a normalization deal isn't off the table. The Saudi-Israeli relationship has actually been ongoing now for months. It's not, if not years, under the table. Dr. Jonathan Shanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, says some experts suggested that the attack occurred in response to recent reports, including during an interview with Brett Baer on Fox News, the chief political anchor, with Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudi Arabia and Israel had neared a point of agreement on normalized relations. The move would have been a major victory for the parties involved, but a major setback for Iran, which has long supported Hamas terrorism in Gaza. And China issued a warning to the U.S. saying those who play with fire will perish by fire. China has reacted to a recent U.S. report weighing up the possibility of simultaneous wars against both Moscow and Beijing by warning Washington that those who play with fire will perish by fire. The U.S. is not ready to face the challenge of the growing nuclear threat posed by Russia and China. This is according to a 145-page report released by the Congressional Commission on the Strategic Posture of the United States on Thursday. In the report, the behavior of both Russia and China is described as militarily troubling and increasingly aggressive, end quote, something that in turn has increased the risk of conflict with two nuclear peers. China is expected to reach nuclear parity with the U.S. by the mid-2030s. Californians are complaining about barely clothed prostitutes roaming the streets in broad daylight, an issue highlighted by Democratic Governor Newsom signing Senate Bill 357, local officials say. The Senate bill, which was authored by Democrat State Senator Scott Weiner and backed by the ACLU, decriminalizes loitering with intent to commit prostitution. Critics say the law effectively decriminalizes prostitution in California. National City Mayor Ron Morrison, an independent, recently criticized the law, saying that prostitutes are now wearing less than what you would consider a scanty negligee and flaunting it in everybody's face. Morrison also said the law, which was signed by Newsom last year, ties the hands of law enforcement, stating that the moment the bill was signed, everyone knew the rules were out the window. When pro-Palestinian protesters chant Palestine from the river to the sea, they're really calling for the extermination of the Jewish state. One former counterterrorism coordinator warned they think that Israel should not exist at all, Nathan Sales told Sunday Night in America. This is exterminationist rhetoric, and our First Amendment means that we have to tolerate this kind of speech, but the antidote is more speech. We need to expose what these Hamas sympathizers are really all about, he says, end quote. Well, several American cities have seen protests against Israel by pro-Palestinian supporters since the 7th of October. The Wexner Foundation is ending its relationship with Harvard University. The nonprofit informed the Ivy League school and its board of overseers of its intentions to do so in a Monday letter. It's closely connected to billionaire El Lands founder Leslie Wexner and his wife, Abigail Wexner, whose names appear on the letter as chairs of the foundation. L Brands once owned retail outlets such as The Limited, Victoria's Secret, Pink, Bath & Body Works, Henry Bendel, and Lane Bryant. The couple created the Wexner Foundation, which describes its focus as being on developing Jewish and Israeli leadership decades ago. And while we intend to develop new strategies and initiatives, we will not be underwriting Harvard University. If you're in Seattle, join us tomorrow for the Bible League Radiothon. If you're in Portland, we'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. Well, one of Taylor Swift's bodyguards on her Eras tour might have been humming her hit song, Look What You Made Me Do, to Hamas as the Israeli-born security agent headed home back to his army unit to fight for the IDF in the wake of the terror attacks there. The guard, who preferred not to give his name, said, "I have a pretty great life in the U.S., a dream job, great friends, and a comfortable home. I didn't have to come here, but I couldn't stand by while families were slaughtered and burned alive in their homes. Don't stand by and do nothing. Don't be on the wrong side of history," end quote. Well, Taylor Swift's Israeli bodyguard is a former IDF soldier. He flew back home to do what former and current IDF officers and soldiers do, defend the nation of Israel. Well, a dude has been named Woman of the Year, only in the 21st century. Well, Dylan Mulvaney, the transgender-identifying man whose sponsorship torpedoed Bud Light, was recently named Woman of the Year by Attitude Magazine. The magazine promotes the LGBTQ agenda, and therefore it comes as no shock that no one that Mulvaney would be celebrated. Anything a woman can do, a man pretending to be a woman can apparently do better. In his acceptance speech, Mulvaney blasted extremist media and those who don't see me as a woman at all. Well, the science denier added that he especially appreciates the award because no matter how hard I try or what I wear or what I say or what surgeries I have, I will never reach an accepted version of womanhood by those hateful people's standard. So again, if you don't embrace the delusion that a man is a woman, then you are motivated by hate, not science, not what we know to be true, but by hate. Well, other than the hateful smear, he accurately recognizes that people care about the truth. They'll never accept a lie about biological reality. At least one of them has an ounce of integrity. Well, Democrat Representative Shri Thander from Minnesota was a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, or the DSA, but announced his resignation from the organization last Thursday. He explained, after the brutal terrorist attacks on Israel, which include the indiscriminate murder, rape, and kidnapping of innocent men, women, and children, I can no longer associate with an organization unwilling to call out terrorism in all its forms, end quote. Not only was the DSA unwilling to condemn Hamas's murderous terrorism against innocent Israelis, but several chapters across the country held rallies in support of Hamas. Sunday's hate-filled anti-Semitic rally in New York City, promoted by the New York City DSA, makes it impossible for me to continue my affiliation, Thander noted. I stand with Israel and its right to defend herself. The GOP has reclaimed the Louisiana governorship. On Saturday, Louisiana held statewide elections, and Republican State Attorney General Jeff Landry unexpectedly won the governor's race outright over a crowded field, receiving over 50% of the vote and thereby avoiding a runoff election in the Bayou State's jungle primary. Landry's win flips the only Deep South state that had a Democrat governor, John Bel Edwards, was term limited. Landry, who had received Donald Trump's endorsement, called the victory a wake-up call, and it's a message that everyone should hear loud and clear, that we, the people in this state, are going to expect more out of our government from here on out. As AG, Landry repeatedly clashed with Edwards and the Biden administration over several issues, including the promotion of gender-bending medical malfeasance on minors and policies limiting oil and gas production. Well, Representative Jordan is still working for 217 votes. The Ohio Republican, he won the nomination to run for Speaker of the House, but he's still working to nail down 217 votes to secure that spot. Fellow Ohioan Mike Turner said this morning that he's confident that we'll have a speaker when the House votes later today. In fact, it may be taking place as I speak. So he's confident. That's good news, considering that there were 55 Republicans who said Friday they were a no on Jordan. Well, Nebraska's Don Bacon said of the seeming stalemate, "We had a small group of folks who broke our rules and got rid of Kevin McCarthy. And then a small group broke our rules and blocked Steve Scalise. Now they want us to follow the rules and support Jim, and I don't like that. I don't play a game where the other guy can break the rules and win," end quote. Well, there will be inevitable horse trading behind the closed doors before the public vote later today. On that Trump gag order, federal judge Tanya Chutkan really doesn't like Donald Trump. And on Monday, she imposed a tailored gag order in Jack Smith's case against the former president for his actions after the 2020 election. "Mr. Trump can certainly claim he's being unfairly prosecuted," Chutkan acknowledged, "but I cannot imagine any other criminal case in which a defendant is permitted to call the prosecutor deranged or a thug, and I will not permit it here simply because the defendant is running for political office. We'll certainly grant that Trump is a rather unique defendant, one with his own social media network to boot, but Chutkan too readily dismisses the First Amendment freedoms of an active presidential candidate in a case she almost certainly has already prejudged." The left media cheered on the narrow and limited order, in quotes, by the way, as a show of restraint on Chutkan's part. Now Trump gets to justifiably and loudly grumble about that, if not defy the order altogether. Now, Trump would probably do a lot better, regardless of what you think about him, if he just talked a little less. I'll put it that way. More Americans think the Biden administration is corrupt, or that the Bidens are corrupt. The Biden crime family, as they're being called by some in Washington, may get away with the lucrative corruption legally, but more and more Americans, despite the wagon circling of the media, know that the president has been up to no good. Well, according to a recent Associated Press poll, 35% of U.S. adults believe the president himself has done something illegal, while an additional 33% say they think the Democratic president behaved unethically, but not illegally. Just 30% think the president is pure as the wind-driven snow, and one wonders what really this is based on. Well, the AP, of course, downplays the whole thing as just over ethical concerns, but the poll shows that more Americans are getting wise to the game. Now, keep in mind, this is what people think. It's not necessarily what they know. And an opinion poll only tells us so much about people's opinions. The jihadists of Hamas, they received a lot of backing from Iran, which is why Mark Alexander said last week that Iran had attacked Israel. The Biden administration, of course, has spent nearly 3 years appeasing Iran, and that was after Barack Obama did likewise for 8 years, literally sending pallets full of cash to the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. Hamas attacked not long after Team Biden unfroze the $6 billion in Iranian assets, which we're told they haven't seen a penny of. In an effort to cover that blunder, Biden said that he'd once again limit access to the money. But Andrew McCarthy insists that hasn't actually happened and can't happen because the United States government no longer has power to freeze the funds. Meanwhile, we're learning that just before Hamas's assault, the Biden administration sent $75 million to Gaza, ostensibly for food. Always remember that money is fungible, and Gaza is led by Hamas. Well, apologists for the organizations are backtracking to the consternation and alarm of decent human beings. Too many people, primarily those who embrace the views on the left, came out of the woodwork to show solidarity with the Palestinian cause, which is a separate issue from my perspective, from Hamas, against their Israeli oppressors, end quotes. From Harvard to Congress, it's been a disgraceful display. The good news is that some of these folks are backtracking in the face of public backlash. Now, one wonders, was it a strongly held belief, or was it in fact just going along with the crowd if they're so easily backtracking? Several Harvard student groups distanced themselves from the infamous joint statement. Of course, there was a threat that they would not be hired by some of the major corporations in the country. The University of Pennsylvania quickly quelled pro-terrorist sentiments in the face of losing donors like former Utah governor and U.S. Ambassador John Huntsman. Chicago's chapter of Black Lives Matter apologized for messages we aren't proud of. Media organizations are suspending or firing scribes and talking heads who spout anti-Semitism. Free speech isn't always free of consequence. Well, Joe Biden's open southern border is a huge humanitarian and economic crisis, but it's also a matter of national security as potential terrorists make their way into our country from the south. On the 1st of October 2022 through August 31st of this year, Customs and Border Protection reported encountering 151 illegal aliens on the terrorist watch list between ports of entry on the southern border. And these are just those they've identified, plus 76 more at ports of entry, reports the Daily Signal. Well, this number doesn't include an unknown number of gotaways who successfully evaded Border Patrol agents and entered the interior of the U.S. The apprehensions include two Iranians whom the Border Patrol said could pose a significant security threat. The simple fact is that when millions of people illegally cross your wide open border, not all of them are sweet families seeking a better life. Hey, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment to wrap things up.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgine Rice Show. Well, Joe Biden is planning to visit Israel. He took off just hours ago today. He'll be in Israel tomorrow. Hamas released the first hostage video in a disgusting propaganda push. Neither Jordan nor Egypt will accept refugees fleeing from Gaza Strip, which is something of a mystery. Brussels shooting, police shot dead, a terrorist who killed Swedes. And the Biden administration and more than 4,000 migrants who were separated from their families at the U.S.-Mexico border by the previous administration reached a legal settlement on Monday that allows the families to live and work in the U.S. for 3 years while receiving housing, mental health, and legal assistance to apply for asylum. The settlement also prohibits the federal government from separating any migrant families crossing the border for 8 years merely for violating U.S. immigration laws. Families could be separated only if the parents are considered a danger to their children or the public. Part of the problem is confirming that the parents, so-called, are in fact the parents of the children they've crossed the border with. What would we do without experts? Runaway inflation is unlikely to be reeled in under the Biden administration, experts now tell us, and in a bit of satire. Terrifying haunted house just displays current gas and grocery prices along dark, creepy hallways. Ooh, it is a little frightening. Well, a darkness has come upon the world. It is an ancient darkness and yet new in its manifestation. It is permeating our media, our entertainment, our marketplaces, our schools, our corporations, our public squares, our governments, our culture, our lives. So writes the author of a new book on Josiah. It is a setting in motion, the transformation of our society, the overturning of ancient foundations and the destruction of age-old standards of morality, value, perception, and faith. It is an unrelenting darkness, one that seeks not only to exist and grow, but to exercise total dominion, to force all it touches into submission, to subjugate language, to alter perception, and to bend reality into its image. It is a darkness that requires every tongue to confess its name and every knee to bow in its homage. As for those who would defy or resist its conquest, it seeks to assimilate and transform them, or else destroy them, even to destroy their will to resist. So it was in the days of the man known in the Bible as Josiah. Josiah was born into a kingdom that had known God but had fallen from his ways. It had come into existence for the purposes of God, but had detached itself from those purposes. It became a civilization, turned it in upon itself and against the foundation of which it stood, on which it stood, an inverted kingdom, a civilization in a state of spiritual schizophrenia. It still invoked his name, but lived in opposition to his ways. Such is the culture in which we now live. American civilization was founded on the reality of God and established for its purposes. But as with ancient Israel, it has fallen and now exists in a state of spiritual schizophrenia, as does its parent, Western civilization. As Western civilization has turned away from God and monotheism in its place, has risen a form of revived paganism. We see it in its defecation of the material world, the deification, if you will, its desanctification of life, its religious syncretism, its moral relativism, its sexualization of popular culture, its abuse of life, its worship of images, and its overturning of biblical standards, values, and precepts. All these things were hallmarks of the ancient paganism of the Middle East. But Josiah was unique. He didn't accept what most of his generation accepted. He did not go along with the status quo, the majority, the tradition of his fathers, or the prevailing norms of his culture. As it was in the days of Manasseh, those who upheld the ways of God became the enemies of the state and culture. They would be deplatformed, demonized, blacklisted, denied admission, expelled, fired, boycotted, banned, silenced, prosecuted, persecuted, canceled, eliminated. Josiah knew he was living in an age of darkness and in a culture given to evil, but instead of accepting the dark and evil in the civilization in which he was born, he set himself against it. He would not go along with it. He would resist. He would fight against it. He embarked on a campaign of national repentance, cleansing, and redemption. Josiah was not only righteous, but bold and courageous. He was not afraid or intimidated by the evil that had taken possession of his culture, because he knew that the power of God was far greater. Spiritual darkness did not discourage Josiah from acting. Rather, it inspired him. He could never have accomplished what he did had he sought the approval of men or feared the wrath of the majority. He broke customs, conventions, and the status quo. He did what others had thought to do, had felt to do, and believed to do, but of fear, did not do. We are living in a time of moral, spiritual, and civilization polarization, where Western civilization is decoupling itself from the faith and the worldview to which it has been joined for nearly 2,000 years. Its mainstream culture is purging itself of Judeo-Christian values, beliefs, laws and practices, worship, ways, and culture. The odds were stacked heavily against Josiah, just as they are now, and they appear heavily stacked against those who seek to uphold and follow the ways of God. But the odds didn't matter to Josiah. The only thing that mattered was the will of God. That was all. And in that he overcame. So it must be for those who seek to stand strong in the face of the present darkness. Like Josiah, we are not to be intimidated by the darkness of our age, but to embrace its challenge. To those who will stand, these will be days that produce greatness. To stand for God in a Judeo-Christian culture is to shine as a candle in the daylight. But to stand for God in a post-Christian, anti-Christian culture is to shine as a candle in the night. The light that shines at night does not blend into its surroundings, but it stands apart from them and against them. It is the contrary light, the light of contradiction, and it is that contrast and that distinction that magnifies its radiance. The greater the contrast between the light and the surrounding darkness, the greater will be its power and impact. The people of God must now make the most of every moment and circumstance to impact their world, in their homes, their workplaces, schools, in their positions of power and influence, their skills and abilities, their experiences and resources, their coming and going, all times and places. They must use all means and resources at their disposal to fulfill the purposes of God. And they must always remember that their most powerful means are not of this world, but spiritual, that of prayer, the word, the presence and power of God. In times of repression or persecution, there may be no other power. If then their only means of spiritual, if their only means are spiritual, it will be enough. For no instrument of man, no force of government, no power on earth is strong enough to stop the means given by the Spirit of God. I would encourage you to check out the story of Josiah found in Scripture that reminds us that you can stand against the tide and that God will be with you when you are determined to represent Him and His holiness with humility, being filled with His Spirit, and being prepared for what comes next. Well, we are out of time. Tomorrow on the program, India Partners, our radiothon. So I'm looking forward to giving you an opportunity to learn more about what the ministry has been up to this past year and to give you an opportunity to support that effort. So I hope you will join us from 4 to 6 tomorrow right here on The Georgine Rice Show. Want to thank James Blind for producing, Dave King for engineering, and thank you for making The Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.